Ask a room of brand professors. When Aker says brand is organization, what exactly is he measuring? Values, heritage, cultural codes, all three. For which audience? Most hands go up when asked, have you used the brand identity model? The silence follows when asked which subcomponents of brand as organization are load-bearing for your primary observer cohort. That silence is not a criticism of Aker. It is the boundary his framework was never designed to cross, and the boundary spectral brand theory is designed to cross.
Right. And it is the cognitive leap from carrying a beautifully illustrated paper map, you know, to turning on the satellite GPS system.
Yeah.
Both show with the terrain, obviously, but only one tells you that the bridge you were about to cross washed out 10 minutes ago.
Wow. Exactly. And look, if you were scratching your head at that silence we just mentioned, do not worry. You're far from alone in that.
Definitely not alone.
Welcome to this deep dive into the architecture of brand perception. We're synthesizing decades of foundational brand theory, specifically the monumental work of David Aker and Jean-Noël Kapfer.
The heavy hitters.
Right, the heavy hitters with the cutting-edge mathematics of spectral brand theory, or SBT for short. And let me tell you why you should care about this.
Please do.
If you have ever sat in a boardroom feeling incredibly frustrated because your internal brand health metrics say you are scoring a 90% on consistency.
We've all been there.
Right. But your sales are flatlining, your customer acquisition costs are just through the roof, and your social media sentiment is a chaotic mess. Well, you are experiencing the boundary of the old system. You have been measuring the code, not the screen.
That frustration is so universal right now. I mean, we are witnessing a fundamental shift in how we understand what a brand actually is in the wild.
Yeah, totally stripped of the, you know, the comforting illusions of corporate marketing departments.
Exactly. We're moving past the illusions.
Five moves today. First, how Aker's four identity perspectives each bundle multiple independent perceptual channels and why unbundling matters for diagnosis. Second, why the core versus extended identity distinction, one of the most useful concepts in brand management, can become empirically discoverable rather than strategist assigned. Third, how the identity image gap is not a communication problem to be closed, but a structural property with a name and a mechanism. Fourth, why coherence type predicts crisis resilience better than consistency score, and what happens to brands that confuse the two. Fifth, how observer heterogeneity turns one brand identity into many structurally, not as noise. The relationship between Aker and SBT is not adversarial. It is the same relationship behavioral economics has to classical economics. The predecessor is preserved as a special case within a more general theory.
I love that roadmap. And let us unpack that foundation first, right? To really appreciate the upgrade, we must respect the original operating system.
For sure. You can't skip the history.
Exactly. So David Aker's 1996 brand identity model, it remains the dominant framework taught in every major business school today. And there is a really profound reason for that.
Yeah.
Before Aker stepped onto the scene, a lot of what executives called, you know, branding was stuck in what he famously termed the brand image trap.
Oh, right. That would be the purely tactical logo focused era.
That's
right?
Pretty much. Yeah.
I just always imagine it as a bunch of executives in the 80s just slapping a shiny new logo on a mediocre product and expecting consumer loyalty to just magically follow.
That is a very, very accurate picture. It was highly reactive. Like if a competitor ran a flashy ad, you ran a flashier one.
Right. It was all surface level.
Exactly. But Aker elevated brand management from an advertising afterthought into a core strategic asset on the balance sheet.
A huge paradigm shift.
Huge. He argued that a brand is not merely a surface layer or a fresh coat of paint. It is a multi-dimensional system that has to be built from the inside out. So he structured this identity through four distinct perspectives to force managers to look beyond just the physical item they were selling.
And those four are brand as product, brand as organization, brand as person, and brand as symbol.
You got it. Those are the big four.
So I want to make sure we really ground those four perspectives before we, you know, tear them apart later.
Good idea.
So let me try to translate these into the real world, and you tell me if I am tracking.
Go for it.
Okay. Brand as product seems straightforward.
Hmm.
It is the tangible offering. Like if I am buying a smartphone, it is the camera quality, the battery life, the actual scope of what the thing literally does.
That tracks perfectly. I mean, it encompasses all the functional attributes, the actual utility and the quality of the item or the service.
Okay, then brand as organization would be looking past the phone and looking at the company making it. Right?
Yes, exactly.
Like their corporate culture. Are they innovating? Do they use sweatshop labor? Do they donate to environmental causes?
The things behind the curtain, essentially.
Right. The kinds of things that are much harder for a competitor in Shenzhen to just reverse engineer than a camera lens.
You hit the nail on the head. Organization focuses on the invisible machinery of the company. It's the ethos.
Awesome. Next is brand as person. This is where we humanize the brand, giving it personality traits.
Right. The cocktail party test.
Exactly. If this brand walked into a cocktail party, who would they be? Are they the rugged outdoorsman?
Yeah.
The sleek, minimalist architect?
It is entirely about building a relationship that feels interpersonal to the consumer.
Make it feel like a human. And finally, brand is symbol, which I am guessing is the visual imagery, the famous swoosh, the heritage, the things that instantly trigger that flash of recognition.
We have the complete architecture right there. That's Akers Foundation. And he also introduced another incredibly durable idea alongside those four perspectives.
Oh, the core versus extended identity.
Yes, the distinction between core identity and extended identity. So the core identity represents the timeless, non-negotiable essence of the brand.
The soul of it.
Exactly. It contains those few central ideas that must remain absolutely stable, even as the brand expands into entirely new global markets or, you know, invents a totally new product categories.
While the extended identity provides the texture.
Right. Yeah, the flexibility.
It is the malleable detail that allows the brand to adapt to specific local contexts without losing its soul.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, a fast food brand might keep its core promise of family joy everywhere.
Sure.
But its extended identity allows it to serve teriyaki burgers in Tokyo and vegetarian curries in Mumbai.
That is the practical application, yes.
Yeah.
It is a brilliant, highly elegant architecture.
It really is.
And to complete the historical picture, we also have to bring Jean-Noël Kapferer into the room.
Ah, Kapferer.
Right. While Aker was building this strategic, very management-focused system in the United States, Kapferer was overdeveloping his brand identity prism in Europe around 1986.
Kapferer always felt a bit more philosophical to me, honestly. Like, he approached it heavily from communication theory and semiotics.
Definitely. He visualized the brand as a speech flowing from a sender, which is the company, to a receiver, the customer.
Right, the whole sender-receiver dynamic.
Yeah. And his prism refracts the brand into six facets: physique, personality, culture, relationship, reflection, and self-image.
The crucial addition Kapferer made was explicitly modeling that receiver side of the equation.
Right, exactly. Aker focused heavily on what the firm was building. Kapferer forced us to look at the psychological reflection happening on the other side.
Let's linger on Kapferer's receiver side concepts for a second, because they are just fascinating.
Yeah.
Reflection and self-image sound super similar, but they operate completely differently.
They really do. They're often confused.
Right. So if I understand it, reflection is the idealized user the brand portrays in its marketing. Think of the outrageously successful, silver-haired professional, effortlessly parallel parking a Mercedes-Benz in Monaco.
The aspirational archetype.
Yes. The brand is saying, this is who drives our cars.
While self-image, on the other hand, is the internal, private, psychological payoff. It is how the actual user feels about themselves when they grip that leather steering wheel.
The reality versus the projection.
Exactly. The driver might actually be a stressed-out middle manager sitting in terrible Tuesday morning traffic, you know?
Yeah.
But for the 45 minutes they are in that Mercedes, their self-image temporarily elevates. They feel powerful.
That makes total sense. So between Aker's strategic corporate architecture and Kapferer's communicative precision, we really established the two great pillars of 20th century brand theory.
The gold standard for decades, yes.
But, and this is the massive turning point of our discussion today, when you try to operate these legacy frameworks today at a massive global scale.
Right.
Or when you attempt to delegate them to computational systems, big data analytics, and artificial intelligence, they just hit a wall.
The math completely breaks down.
It breaks down.
Yeah.
We have identified three specific hard structural boundaries where Aker's model simply stops functioning. Let's walk through them.
Okay, so the first boundary is perspective selection. Aker provides these four perspectives: product, organization, person, symbol. But he offers absolutely no scientific mechanism for deciding which of them actually matters most for your specific brand.
Zero mechanism.
None. It relies entirely on the subjective judgment of the strategist in the room.
Oh, man, it is the expert in the room problem. This drives me crazy.
It's infuriating, isn't it?
You could hire a million-dollar branding agency, and their charismatic creative director will stand up and declare, for this campaign, we must focus on brand as person.
And everyone just nods along because the slides look pretty.
Exactly. But if you are a luxury heritage fashion house, versus a direct-to-consumer cybersecurity software company, you operate in fundamentally different perceptual spaces.
Completely different physics.
Right. Relying on a consultant's gut instinct doesn't scale, and it certainly cannot be programmed into an algorithm.
No, it can't. And that leads to the second boundary, which is just as problematic, element prioritization.
Okay, unpack that one.
Determining what actually belongs in that sacred core identity versus the flexible extended identity lacks any empirical foundation in the original model.
Give me an example of how that fails in practice, like out in the wild.
Look at Coleman's major study in 2011. They attempted to fully operationalize Aker's model for business-to-business markets. They wanted to really test it empirically.
Right.
But because Aker provided no mathematical way to sort the core from the extended, Coleman's team literally had to build a custom measurement scale from scratch just to figure it out.
They had to invent the ruler to measure the room.
Exactly. Without a standardized metric, two seasoned practitioners looking at the exact same brand data will often disagree entirely on what its core essence actually is.
Which brings us to the third boundary, which honestly might be the most important. Gap resolution. Both Ayer and Kapfer readily acknowledge the identity image gap.
The gap is famous.
Right. This is the painful difference between what the company intends to project and what the consumers actually perceive.
The limitation, though, is how they treat that gap. They view it almost exclusively as a communication failure.
Like it's just a bad ad.
Exactly. If consumers do not perceive us as innovative, well, we must be running the wrong ads. We just need to speak louder or clearer.
Yeah.
They cannot parameterize the underlying mechanics of why three different demographic groups will experience three completely different gaps simultaneously.
Even when watching the exact same television commercial.
Precisely. They lack the structural theory for the observer.
It's like Kahneman didn't invalidate Adam Smith. He gave him a coordinate system. Aker gave brand management a vocabulary. The SBT gives that vocabulary coordinates.
That transition is vital to keep in mind. I'm glad you brought that up. We are not discarding Aker here.
Right. We're building on him.
To apply these new coordinates, we have to look closely at what Aker's vocabulary is actually holding together. Aker's four perspectives are brilliant, but they are bundled concepts.
Bundled? How do you mean?
They smash multiple, completely independent human perceptions into single buckets. Spectral brand theory unbundles them into eight precisely parameterized dimensions.
The canonical eight dimensions. Okay, let me list them out so we have them firmly on the board for you listening.
Good idea.
We've got semiotic, narrative, ideological, experiential, social, economic, cultural, and temporal.
Those are the eight.
Now, let's play a game of translation. How does the unbundling work in practice? Let's take Aker's brand as product. In the SBT framework, how does it split apart?
So, brand as product splits cleanly into two distinct SBT dimensions. First, you have the experiential dimension, which captures the tactile reality, how the product actually feels in your hand, how the software interface functions, the raw physical utility of the thing.
And the second.
Second is the economic dimension, which governs its price, its perceived value, and its overall market positioning.
I want to stop and put a massive spotlight on the economic dimension for a second, because this is a radical departure.
It really is.
In almost every other model, price is just considered another feature, like color or size. But SBT isolates it because it is completely unique. It is an adversarial dimension.
Yes. It is the only dimension where the interests of the company and the interests of the customer are structurally inherently opposed.
It's a zero-sum game, essentially.
Exactly. The company always desires to charge more to maximize margin. The customer always desires to pay less to maximize personal resources.
It is a permanent tug-of-war. And when you bundle that adversarial reality into the exact same theoretical bucket as product quality, which Aker does, you completely obscure the actual dynamic at play.
You blind yourself to what's really happening.
Right. You cannot diagnose why a customer loves your product's features but furiously hates your brand, which happens all the time with, like, software subscription models today.
Oh, constantly.
They love the experiential, but they are absolutely rebelling against the economic.
That's a perfect example. Let us move to brand as organization, then. Under Aker, this is a massive, unwieldy container. Under SBT, it unbundles into three highly specific dimensions.
Okay, let's hear them.
The ideological dimension, which covers the company's stated values, its ethics, its social purpose. Then the cultural dimension, which is all about aesthetic codes, tribal alignments, and how the brand synchronizes with the broader zeitgeist.
And the third?
And finally, the temporal dimension, which signals heritage, longevity, and track record.
Okay, I see the power of that split immediately. Because a company might have an incredible century-old track record, meaning they're scoring high on the temporal dimension,
right,
but have absolutely toxic corporate values, completely failing the ideological dimension. Akers' bundled organization metric would just average those out into a murky middle score that tells you literally nothing.
It just gives you noise.
Okay, let's keep the translation going. What about brand as person?
That splits into the narrative dimension, the brand's origin story, the founder's myth, its character arc over time. And it also splits into the social dimension.
The social dimension being?
Which governs community belonging, peer dynamics, and how using the brand actually elevates your status within a specific group.
Makes sense. And lastly, brand is symbol.
That resolves into the semiotic dimension, the literal visual identity, the logos, the recognizable surface layer, the typography.
Right, the stuff you can see.
Exactly. And it also pulls in the temporal dimension again because deep heritage acts as a remarkably powerful symbolic resource. Think of like a royal warrant on a bottle of scotch.
Oh, that's a great visual. Actually, speaking of visuals, I want to paint a picture for everyone listening to really lock this in.
Please do.
Imagine a diagram. Let's refer to it as visual 3 from the source literature. On the left side of your mental screen, you have Akers' 4 identity perspectives drawn as solid, heavy shipping containers.
Big steel boxes.
Yeah. Product, organization, person, symbol. Now, on the right side of the screen, you have the 8 SBT dimensions arranged in a circle on a radar chart.
It functions as a mapping exercise.
Yes. So imagine drawing physical lines connecting the two signs. An arrow originates from the heavy brand as organization container on the left, but as it moves across the screen to the radar chart, it splits into 3 separate threads.
Beautiful.
Pointing to ideological, cultural, and temporal. This visual proves that SBT isn't throwing Aker away. It is putting his concepts through a prism and watching the light separate into distinct wavelengths.
The visual of the prism is highly appropriate, you know, given Kapfer's early work.
But let me play devil's advocate for a moment here.
Bring it on.
I can hear a stressed out marketing director listening to this and just groaning. Wait, you are taking my 4 easy to understand concepts and breaking them into 8 complicated academic dimensions. Isn't this just overcomplicating things to sell consulting hours?
The classic pushback.
Yeah. Why do we actually need this exhausting level of granularity?
Because without that granularity, your diagnosis is way too blunt to be actionable in the real world. Under the Aker framework, you run an audit and ask a qualitative question like, is our brand as organization compelling to the market?
Right. And asking whether your brand as organization is compelling is like asking whether the patient has a fever. It is a starting point, not a diagnosis.
Exactly. If the answer comes back, no, it is not compelling, what do you actually instruct your teams to go fix on Monday morning?
You have no idea.
Do you rewrite your mission statement? Do you change your hiring practices? SBT forces you to isolate the variable. Is it the ethical values story on the ideological dimension that is failing to resonate?
Or maybe the aesthetic.
Right. Are the visual aesthetics on the cultural dimension feeling outdated to a younger demographic? Or is the heritage claim on the temporal dimension being viewed as irrelevant?
And crucially, for which specific cohort of observers?
Yes. That massive increase in diagnostic resolution is the entire point. It graduates brand management from qualitative intuition to precise surgical engineering.
Okay, so we have successfully unbundled the dimensions. We have our 8 coordinates. But that brings us directly to Akers' second boundary, which we touched on earlier.
Right, the core versus extended issue.
Exactly. How do we scientifically, objectively, determine what is core to the brand without relying on the highest paid person's opinion?
Under traditional legacy models, you decide what is core in a boardroom. A group of executives look at a whiteboard, brainstorm for an afternoon, and loudly declare innovation and approachability are our core identity.
Which usually just reflects their own egos.
Totally. But under spectral brand theory, the core identity is never declared. It is empirically discoverable through a mathematical mechanism called spectral weights.
Hold on. We are getting into the heavy math now. Let's make sure nobody gets left behind. What exactly is spectral weight in plain English?
Think about it like a set of internal equalizer sliders that every consumer has in their head.
Like on a mixing board.
Exactly. Every group of observers, what SBT calls an observer cohort, assigns different levels of importance to those eight dimensions when they evaluate a brand.
Okay.
A highly price-sensitive cohort pushes the slider for the economic dimension all the way up. They care about value above all else.
Well, another group might care about something else entirely.
Right. A highly purpose-driven, activist cohort pushes the ideological slider all the way up. In SBT, the dimensions that naturally possess the highest cohort average weights are the core identity.
It is dictated by the audience's reliance on the trait, not the company's desire to own the trait.
That's the crux of it.
Because if you, as the brand, alter or remove those specific, heavily weighted dimensions, the entire perception of the brand destabilizes for that group. They literally stop recognizing you.
And this is not just theoretical conjecture, by the way. There is a remarkably strong psychological precedent for this.
Where does it come from?
Way back in 1970, researchers Carroll and Chang developed something called IND-SCL. It was a multidimensional scaling model used in psychology.
Give me a real-world equivalent of how IND-SCL actually works.
Imagine three different people evaluating a group of cars. Person A is a mechanic, person B is a soccer mom, and person C is a wealthy bachelor.
Okay, I'm picturing them.
The IND-SCL model proved mathematically that these individuals do not just disagree on which car is best, they fundamentally stretch and shrink the perceptual dimensions they use to judge the cars in the first place.
Oh, interesting.
The mechanic stretches the engine reliability dimension so it dominates his entire view. The soccer mom stretches the safety and seating dimension. The bachelor stretches the aesthetic status dimension.
So they are looking at the exact same physical vehicles, but they are evaluating them using entirely different weighted architectures.
Precisely. SBT simply scales that individual laboratory insight up to massive global brand cohorts.
Core identity is not what the strategist decides is timeless. It is what the data shows the primary observer cohort cannot lose.
That represents a profound, almost uncomfortable shift in power for traditional executives.
I bet they hate it.
Oh, many do. The data dictates the core, not the CEO. And this realization leads us directly to how SBT solves Aker's third boundary, the identity image gap.
Right.
Aker knew there was a painful difference between what a brand intends to say and what consumers actually hear. SBT takes that concept, removes the blame of poor communication, and rebrands it as a structural law of physics known as the rendering problem.
The rendering problem. I love that phrasing so much. We need to lean into this because it explains so much of the modern landscape.
It's a great term.
I picture it exactly like computer graphics in video games.
Walk me through your visualization on that.
Okay, so imagine a studio codes, a highly detailed state-of-the-art video game. That underlying code is your brand specification. It is perfect, it is detailed, it is exactly what you intend.
Okay.
But one player downloads that code and runs it on a massive brand new OLED 4K television with a top-tier graphics card. Another player downloads the exact same code and runs it on a dusty 15-year-old laptop with a cracked screen.
I see where this is going.
The code, the brand signal you emitted, is mathematically identical. But the rendered image the user actually experiences is completely different. The dusty laptop drops frames, loses colors, and blurs all the edges.
Exactly.
The gap isn't because you coded the game poorly. The gap exists because you cannot control the hardware of the observer. SBP measures the hardware.
That is an exceptional analogy. The rendering problem is the irreducible distance between what the brand specifies, the signals it broadcasts into the world, and what observers are physically and culturally capable of perceiving.
And the sum total of those rendered perceptions forms what SBT calls the perception cloud.
Yes. The cloud is the reality.
Okay, if we have a perception cloud, what happens to Aker's famous brand essence? In the old days, brand essence was that catchy single sentence at the center of the brand wheel that was supposed to capture the soul of the company. Does that still exist?
It exists, but it transforms from poetry into geometry.
Geometry.
Yes. Under SBT, that brand essence is defined as the centroid of the perception cloud in eight-dimensional spectral space.
Whoa, stop right there.
Centroid in eight-dimensional space. I'm suddenly picturing a dense astrophysics textbook.
It sounds intimidating, I know.
Translate that into English for me. If I am looking at a physical cloud, let's say a massive swarm of bees, what is the centroid?
The centroid is simply the center of gravity. If you track where every single bee is flying at a given moment, some are far out on the edges, some are clustered super tight in the middle.
Okay.
The centroid is the exact mathematical middle point of the entire swarm. In brand terms, Every consumer's individual perception is a BE. They are all slightly different. But if you average out the weights of all those millions of perceptions across the eight dimensions, you find the center of gravity.
So the essence isn't a sentence, it's a coordinate.
Exactly. That central coordinate is the true brand essence. It is where the perception cloud is anchored.
I'm going to push back hard on this whole concept, though.
Let's hear it.
If the identity image gap, the rendering problem, is structurally irreducible, meaning no finite amount of marketing, no perfectly written brand specification can ever perfectly dictate human perception.
Yeah.
What's the point of doing brand strategy at all?
Are we just giving up?
Yeah. Are we just shouting into the void and hoping the laptop renders it decently?
Not at all. The goal of modern brand strategy is not to close the gap to zero. Trying to make every single human being perceive your brand identically is a fool's errand. It's impossible.
Right.
The goal is to measure the gap, understand exactly why it exists for different cohorts, and manage it within known acceptable tolerances. You are trying to engineer your signal architecture so that the resulting perception clouds, while perhaps different, are functionally compatible.
That makes a lot of sense.
Let go.
You are managing the gap actively rather than weeping over the fact that we cannot eliminate it.
Exactly. So if that is the goal, how do we measure our success? If I look at traditional brand health trackers, Aker and everyone else says we should look for a high consistency score. But spectral brand theory comes in and says consistency is actually incredibly dangerous if you do not know your coherence type.
This might be the most critical paradigm-shifting insight of the entire framework. Consistency is merely a scalar metric.
Just a number.
Just a single flat number that tells you how much the brand repeats itself across channels. Coherence, on the other hand, is structural. It describes how the different observer cohorts interrelate and react to those signals.
That reminds me heavily of Sorensen's famous 2002 study on organizational culture. He proved that the type of cultural alignment within a company predicts long-term performance outcomes much better than cultural strength.
That is the exact analog. Sorensen showed that incredibly strong, consistent corporate cultures perform exceptionally well in highly stable, predictable environments.
But when things change, right, the moment the market gets volatile, those strong cultures become brittle and shatter because they cannot adapt. The structural type of the alignment matters far more than the raw degree of it. SBT applies that exact same insight to bland perception clouds.
Okay, visual time again. I want everyone to picture a table. We will call it Visual 3, the coherence type hierarchy.
A very important table.
Imagine a spreadsheet with 5 rows ordered top to bottom by the resilience to crisis. Column 1 names the coherence type. Column 2 explains the structure. Column 3 reveals their crisis response. And column 4 gives us the canonical example.
Let's walk through it.
We need to spend real time here because this is where the theory hits the pavement. Let's dive into these 5 types, starting from the very top.
The absolute most resilient architecture a brand can achieve is ecosystem coherence. We assign this an A+ grade.
And the example here.
The canonical example of this is the luxury house Hermès. In an ecosystem coherence structure, the different observer cohorts do not just share a perception, they are functionally interdependent. They actually require each other to validate the brand.
Break down how that actually works for Hermès. How do different cohorts need each other?
Think about the mechanics of the Hermès Birkin bag. You have a massive aspiration cohort, millions of people who deeply desire the brand, engage with its imagery, but absolutely cannot afford it or access it.
Right.
Then you have the tiny exclusion cohort, the ultra high net worth buyers who purchase the bags precisely because of their extreme scarcity.
Ah, I see.
The aspiration cohort needs the high end buyers to validate the bag's legendary status. But more importantly, the exclusion cohort needs the aspiration cohort to desire the bag. If the masses stop wanting it, the wealthy stop buying it. The two cohorts reinforce each other's spectral weights.
And their crisis response is fascinating. When disruption hits, they absorb it selectively by purifying. Explain what they do on the economic dimension to maintain this.
They utilize what we call structural absence or dark signals. Hermès does not run sales. They do not offer discounts. They maintain brutal geographic and inventory scarcity.
Even in a recession.
Especially in a recession. When a global recession hits, while other brands panic and flood the market with discounts to prop up revenue, which fundamentally damages their core identity, Hermès does nothing.
Wow.
Doing nothing is an active, highly engineered strategy. By starving the economic dimension of typical retail signals, they actively protect the temporal and cultural dimensions.
So that is the absolute gold standard. Moving down the hierarchy,
Type number two is signal coherence. We give this a grade of A. The canonical example here is IKEA.
Right. Signal coherence means that highly consistent, heavily designed signals produce highly consistent perception clouds for virtually everyone who interacts with the brand.
No matter who they are.
Exactly. A university student buying a cheap LAC table for their dorm room and a wealthy design professional outfitting a creative studio both see essentially the exact same brand proposition. Democratic design, flat pack affordability, and Scandinavian functionality. The signals are completely uniform.
And their crisis response is also uniform. They transmit uniformly. If a massive quality scandal hits IKEA, say, a recall on a dresser, it hits every single cohort equally. The student and the professional both lose trust at the exact same rate.
Which highlights the hidden risk of this type. The danger for IKEA isn't a divided audience. The danger is signal fatigue.
Signal fatigue.
Yeah. When a brand becomes so perfectly consistent across every touch point, observers eventually habituate to it. It fades into background expectation. It stops being an active choice and just becomes infrastructure.
Just there.
Exactly.
Type three brings us to identity coherence, grade B plus B. And the classic unavoidable example here is Patagonia.
Identity coherence relies on an overwhelmingly strong ideological core. Patagonia's commitment to environmental activism and anti-consumerism acts as an intense magnetic field.
This is where we see a crisis response that is entirely binary, right?
Yes, very binary. When Patagonia does something controversial, like their famous Don't Buy This Jacket campaign, which intentionally introduced friction into the purchasing process to protest overconsumption.
Right.
The response splits perfectly. Aligned cohorts rally incredibly tightly. They double down on their loyalty and advocate fiercely for the brand.
But the unaligned?
Misaligned cohorts, people who just want a cheap fleece and dislike environmental politics, are actively repelled. The brand operates as either a powerful magnet or a solid wall, depending entirely on the observer's spectral profile. They willingly sacrifice total market size to maximize cohort density.
That brings us to type four, experiential asymmetry. Grade B. I find this one the most fascinating because it is just so common in the Instagram era. Think of Erewhon, the ultra-premium, notoriously expensive grocery store in Los Angeles.
Experiential asymmetry occurs when the perception cloud is vivid, highly detailed, and high conviction for local or direct cohorts who actually interact with the physical space.
The people who actually walk in the door.
Right. But for mediated cohorts, people who experience the brand only through secondary channels like social media, the cloud is diffuse, shallow, or almost non-existent.
But how do they structurally engineer that asymmetry? Because it is not an accident.
It is achieved through a combination of extreme economic gatekeeping and cultural aesthetics. Erewhon sells $20 celebrity smoothies.
$20?
Exactly. That absurd price point on the economic dimension acts as a physical wall. It keeps the local direct cohort very small and exclusive.
Okay, but what about the rest of the internet?
However, the visual presentation of those smoothies, the typography on the cups, the celebrities carrying them, that fires incredibly strong signals on the cultural and semiotic dimensions, which travel perfectly across TikTok.
Oh, wow.
So millions of mediated observers desire the aesthetic, while a tiny local cohort actually experiences the utility.
It's brilliant, really. And finally, we arrive at the absolute bottom of the hierarchy. Type 5. Incoherent. Grade C. The prime example here is Tesla.
Tesla represents maximum emission power coupled with minimum structural health. With Tesla, we estimate roughly 65% of the brand signals do not come from design corporate communications.
Where do they come from?
They come ambiently from the CEO, Elon Musk, via his social media presence, political statements, and public behavior.
And because those signals are often impulsive and extremely erratic, they produce completely irreconcilable perception clouds among different groups.
Tesla's crisis response is catastrophic. It amplifies every single disruption.
Why does it amplify it?
Because you have five different observer cohorts holding completely contradictory convictions about what the brand stands for, all built from the exact same stream of signals.
Give me an example of the split.
You have early adopters who view it as a green energy crusade. You have tech bros who view it as a Silicon Valley software platform. You have political cohorts who view it as a proxy for free speech libertarianism.
So they're all seeing a different brand.
Exactly. When a disruption occurs, these clouds do not support each other like Hermes. They violently crash into each other.
I want to use an analogy from optics here to really cement why consistency is the wrong metric to look at. Think about the phenomenon of color metamerism.
I like this analogy.
Two light sources, say a fluorescent tube and an LED bulb, can look perfectly identical to the human eye in a white room. They appear to be the exact same shade of white.
Right.
But physically, they are emitting completely different invisible wavelengths. If you change the lighting conditions even slightly, say you hold up a red apple, suddenly the apple looks bright red under one light and muddy brown under the other.
The illusion shatters.
The illusion of consistency breaks down. Brand health scores do the exact same thing. Two brands can score identically on a consistency metric and have completely opposite resilience profiles. Coherence type is not a refinement of consistency. It is a different question.
That is a phenomenal analogy. A score of 78 out of 100 on a corporate consistency tracker hides the underlying physics. It completely hides the fact that the 78 for Hermes represents an indestructible ecosystem, while the 78 for another brand represents a fragile house of cards ready to collapse under a new lighting condition.
Tesla is consistent. Every observer recognizes it. Tesla is incoherent. Five observer cohorts hold irreconcilable convictions about what it stands for.
And this naturally begs the ultimate question. The reason these coherence types exist, the reason Tesla has five contradictory convictions, and the reason Hermes can use dark signals, all comes down to the ultimate blind spot in 20th century brand theory, the observer.
We mentioned this briefly with Capra, but we need to go deeper now. Ecker builds his model assuming there is one static brand identity, and it's perceived relatively uniformly by all audiences.
Yes.
Kaffer and later Keller acknowledge the receiver, but they almost always treat the customer as a singular uniform construct, a monolith.
Spectral brand theory fundamentally changes the paradigm by formally introducing the observer spectral profile. We touched on the sliders earlier.
Right.
But an observer's profile is actually made up of four specific components. First, their dimensional weights, what they actually care about. Second, their tolerances for inconsistency, how much variance they will forgive before abandoning the brand.
Okay.
Third, their priors, their deeply held existing brand convictions. And fourth, the identity gate, the threshold of whether they even recognize the brand's signals in the clutter to begin with.
This requires us to break down a fundamental marketing vocabulary error.
Yeah.
We have to separate a demographic segment from a perceptual cohort. Marketers use these interchangeably, and it ruins their data.
It completely ruins it. Traditional market segmentation clusters audiences by observable external characteristics, age, income bracket, zip code, gender.
But a cohort.
But a cohort in SBT is defined as a cluster in spectral profile space. It groups people by how they process signals, regardless of their demographics.
Let me give a concrete example to make sure this really lands for everyone.
Right.
Imagine two 35-year-old urban professionals. They both earn $100,000 a year. They both live in downtown Chicago. They both work in finance.
Okay, very similar on paper.
Demographically, they are identical. They're in the exact same traditional marketing segment. But suppose they're both shopping for a luxury watch.
Let's see how they split.
One of them heavily weights the temporal dimension. They want a Patek Philippe because they care about century-old heritage, legacy, and passing it down to their children. The other heavily weights the ideological dimension. They want a high-end smart watch made from recycled ocean plastic because they prioritize environmental sustainability.
Boom.
They're in the same segment, looking at the same luxury category, but they're in entirely different SBT cohorts. They are literally perceiving different things.
The empirical foundation for this mechanism is rock solid in the academic literature, too. Greer and Brumbaugh proved way back in 1999 that identical advertisements produce systematically different meanings in target versus non-target groups.
Their backgrounds literally warp the ad.
Yes. Their cultural positions and their priors acted as filters, warping the signal differently. And Puntoni and his colleagues documented this extensively in 2011 with the concept of purposeful polysemy.
I need an ELI-5 on purposeful polysemy. Break that down for a layman.
Polysemy just means having multiple meanings. Purposeful polysemy is when a brand designs communications that deliberately carry two different meanings for two different audiences simultaneously without either audience feeling alienated.
Oh, like a dual-layer message.
Think of a classic Pixar movie. There are slapstick jokes designed specifically for the five-year-olds, and there are nuanced emotional jokes about parenthood designed specifically for the 35-year-olds watching with them.
I love that.
It is one single movie, one signal, but it triggers completely different parallel perception clouds based on the observer's priors. Brands can engineer this exact dynamic.
So to drive this entire concept home and put it on a bumper sticker, a segment is who the observer is. A cohort is what the observer sees.
I could not have phrased it better myself. And this is where we see the ultimate harmonious relationship between Acres Foundation and the SBT upgrade.
Full circle.
Yes. SBT does not destroy Acres' model. It mathematically encompasses it. Think about the theoretical limiting case here. Ask yourself, what happens to the math if you have a perfectly homogeneous market where every single observer happens to share the exact same spectral profile?
When all observers share the same spectral profile, SBT reduces to acre. Acre is the special case of zero observer heterogeneity.
Exactly. If everyone in the world weights the eight dimensions identically and everyone processes signals uniformly, then Acre's single identity boardroom defined model works perfectly.
But we do not live in that world.
Not even close.
In the real world, especially for global, premium, or highly digital brands, markets are wildly heterogeneous. You have multiple observer cohorts processing your signals simultaneously, bringing their own biases, priors, and hardware to the rendering process.
That is exactly when you need the eight-dimensional coordinates.
So we have covered an immense amount of ground today. What does this all mean for the practitioner listening right now? The brand manager driving to work or the strategist staring at a deck? How do you actually apply this tomorrow?
The beauty and the relief of this framework is that you do not have to throw away Acre. Keep using the vocabulary.
Please keep using it.
Right. It is the shared language of global brand management, and throwing it out would cause absolute chaos. But to upgrade a standard Acre audit into a spectral audit, you simply have to ask one additional rigorous question after your initial analysis.
And that question is?
Which of SBT's eight dimensions carry the weight in that perspective, and for which observer cohort?
That one question is the key that unlocks the whole system.
Yes. If your boardroom declares that your brand as organization needs work because it is scoring low, do not just blindly throw money at a new corporate culture campaign.
Pause and ask the question.
Stop and ask the follow-up. Is it the ideological, cultural, or temporal dimension that is actually dragging the score down? And more importantly, who are we investing it for? Which cohort actually cares about that dimension, and are they profitable enough to justify the investment?
Lecture 1 covers SBT's complete formal framework, coherence types, metamerism, the 70-80-100 problem, and non-ergodic dynamics.
It's a deep rabbit hole.
Episode 16 applies the same formalization to a quick practitioner walkthrough. The SBT framework paper and this lecture's source paper are both available on Zenodo with 20-plus related papers.
Adopting this framework is a profound cognitive shift. You evolve from managing what you say to actively managing what different cohorts see.
As we wrap up this deep dive, I want to leave you with a final, slightly mind-bending thought to mull over. We have spent this entire time talking about human psychology.
Right.
We've talked about how human observer cohorts weight dimensions, render signals, and form perception clouds based on their culture and demographics. But what happens to brand identity when the observer cohort isn't human?
Ooh, that is the frontier.
As AI agents increasingly begin parsing brand signals, synthesizing global data, and making autonomous purchasing recommendations based on entirely non-human spectral profiles, how will your brand render in the mind of an algorithm? That X-ray machine we talked about, it's about to get a massive software update. Until next time.